in the case of airships, the square cube law actually works in your favor because you have more volume. Volume increases as the cube, and surface area increases only as the square, which means that for each additional cubic meter of volume, you'd get less than a cubic meter of drag, which is less than a square meter of drag. How do you beat Jeff Bezos's yacht? Well, you know, you put a skyscraper in the sky. I feel like that's a pretty bold statement. The other thing about airships important to me is that they're as symbols, they kind of change your perspective of what's possible. But the real power of this stuff is in the future. We have not had any native applications built yet in AI. When AlphaGo came out, you know, and then the famous games against Lee Sedol, and then the famous Move 37. And they looked at how this thing played, and they started using its intuitions to find new and more creative moves for themselves as humans. I want that for other fields. So the thing that I really want, I want a Move 37 for mathematics. It's very interesting to see how Ford thought about the Model T Ford, not just as a car, but as part of a complete economic system, right?
Today I have the pleasure of speaking with Anton Chernikov, who's the founder or co-founder of Chroma, and also a fellow techno-optimist and pretty, I would say, well-read in the meme space of these ideas, and especially knowledge retrieval, an expert in that topic as well. So, Anton, would love to start sort of with your story. I know we talked a bit about it, where we talked about airships and so on, but yeah, could you give us a background about your story?
Yeah. Look, I'm gonna steal that phrase. Well read in this meme sphere. I might change my Twitter bio to say that. My story. Look, I start at the very start. I was born in the Soviet Ukraine. My family emigrated to Australia. I grew up there in Melbourne. Time in 2018, I left Australia more or less permanently to sort of pursue my first startup, which was in education technology. Which, you know, and that's something that I did for about 3 years with my co-founders. It was an extremely difficult thing. I don't recommend that anybody do an education technology startup, but at the time it seemed worthwhile and definitely learned a lot. And I still think that the core ideas of what we were building were actually important and we had a good approach, but the market is absolutely brutal. And also, of course, you know, also being in my sort of early 20s, not really knowing what I was doing, having never done a startup before or really experienced startups, meant that I made a lot of mistakes along the way, but it was a great experience. I wouldn't trade it for anything else. We left Australia for Berlin first, where I lived for a number of years. At one point, we were funded by Imagine K-12, which was the EdTech spinoff of Y Combinator. So we moved to the States. We lived in Palo Alto with four guys in a two-bedroom duplex apartment, which was also our office. And then, you know, we sort of folded that company. I went back to Germany. I lived in Berlin for a while longer, and then I went to grad school in Munich for applied math and CS, focusing on perception for robotics. Sort of did what I think of as a PhD speed run during that time, where I basically enrolled in a master's, but de facto did research pretty much the entire time, and also did practical work and as much as I could to be sort of in the real world of machine perception and robotics. And then when I finished up grad school, and you know, I did my thesis, Professor Daniel Kremer's lab there in 3D computer vision, multi-target tracking in a direct photometric context. And probably a lot of your listeners don't really know what that means, but that's okay. I really enjoyed doing it.
What kind of context? 3D tracking
in a direct photometric context. So basically we're talking about using only pixels and the structure of 3D space to do multi-target tracking, which is, it's a fairly difficult problem. And, you know, I dug into it fairly deeply in my thesis, but didn't exactly solve it, but did learn a lot about it. Yeah, came to the States again in 2018. In between those two periods, like I mentioned, I sort of contracted an intern and worked at a bunch of different places working in robotics, machine perception, everything from like self-driving cars and drones. And once I worked on this crazy project where basically a large German car manufacturer subcontracted out this project to try to map cities using parking cameras, which is actually surprisingly effective, surprisingly successful. It kind of works. It's just the maps that it creates aren't very useful, it turns out.
Cameras meaning the cameras that observe the parking space, or?
Parking cameras as in the cameras that, I don't know if you've driven a car lately, but most cameras now have like a reverse.
Oh,
parking camera. Okay. They have sensors on the sides that tell you if you're close to the curb. And basically the sort of the big auto manufacturer wanted to see if they could use those for computer vision related things. And it turns out you can. I worked on that. I put together the first self-driving race car project at the Technical University of Munich. I was the leader of that project for a time, which, you know, ended up for a variety of reasons, bootstrapping that team from the ground up, which was a very cool thing to do. I worked over in the States during that time doing 3D perception for drones. And then, yeah, later on, I moved to the US in 2018, more or less permanently. I've been here since then. Worked on, you know, again, 3D computer vision perception for self-driving, for AR, VR stuff. And then, yeah, founded Chroma with my co-founder, Jeff Huber, in May of last year. And that pretty much brings us up to the present day. I've been doing Chroma essentially full-time since then. It's been the entire focus of my efforts and energies, which fortunately in recent months, in the last few months, has definitely started to pay off. So it's been a pretty long and eventful journey. But now it feels like a lot of the groundwork that I laid throughout that period is really paying off. So
yeah. Awesome. Just for context, I'm curious, what was the EdTech thing that you worked on?
Yeah, I actually posted about this on Twitter, and I can link the thread to you later. But the idea, I don't know if you and your listeners are familiar with the Bloom's 2 sigma effect.
Yep.
Yeah, so Bloom's 2 sigma, just to recap briefly, is the fact that individual, like one-on-one tutoring, has a 2 sigma outsized effect in improving educational outcomes compared to every other kind of intervention, right? And what we had hoped to do was, by providing classroom teachers with individual data about each of their students in a format that actually was very similar to Mixpanel or Google Analytics. Like, we modeled sort of the curriculum as a funnel, and, you know, students would be gated on topics, and you would see who was making it past each gate and how they were doing, and what specifically what parts of the curriculum they were struggling with or you know, needed to be pushed further in. And the way that we did that was basically this was very early, remember, this was 2013. So sort of the idea of iPads or smartphones in the classroom was very new at the time. Mm. This is me showing my age, right? And so we figured that, well, there's a lot of these classroom tasks which are actually really valuable for collecting information. And, you know, they're called formative assessment in the education world, that we could actually make a lot easier for teachers to perform in their classroom and at the same time capture this individuated data. Which would maybe help us capture part of this Bloom's 2 sigma effect. And I think the idea itself is actually really good. And we built a really solid product. I'm actually very proud of what we built. The main issue was the way education is structured, especially in the United States, does not give teachers room to try new tools, to really incorporate new ways of teaching in their classroom.
Right, and they're not even incentivized to do that.
Well, they're not incentivized. Not only are they incentivized, they're punished. Mm-hmm. And the reason that they're punished, and, you know, people have these misconceptions that, oh, you know, teachers are, I don't know what it is like now. Maybe things have changed in the last, you know, 10 years, it's literally 10 years, which is crazy to think about for me. But at the time, for me, it was pretty obvious that most teachers, classroom teachers, were very dedicated to their students. They really wanted them to have good outcomes, right? But there was so much other bullshit that they had to do imposed on them. By school administrations and by parent teacher associations, right? Hmm. Because, you know, parents don't like to hear that their students maybe are struggling or that they're not doing well in class. And so they will impose insane requirements on teachers, which essentially prevent them from picking up new tools. Because what happens is, like, if you don't fill out, you know, just when I saw the amount of paperwork that teachers actually had to perform in the classroom, it was kind of insane. It's like, nobody is going to fire you, or your career as an educator is not going to be slowed down if you don't pick up a new tool, but you will be slowed down if you spend all this time doing this admin bullshit, right? Right. A teacher's day doesn't end when class finishes, you know, it's why they, you know, teachers like, oh, they have summer off. They don't. They're doing all this nonsense administrative work, which has nothing to do with teaching kids.
Yeah.
So that made it difficult for us or for any other sort of new tool to really enter the classroom and be effective. Only, you know, very few education technology startups over the last few years have really gotten anywhere. And certainly at the classroom level, I can only think of ClassDojo and Remind as being effective. We currently have a new crop of homeschooling oriented ed tech startups. If somebody held a gun to my head and forced me to do another ed tech, And, you know, if Chrome is very successful, I may, because I am actually very bullish on AI for education. I would do it for homeschooling. I'm not, to be completely honest, I'm not that impressed by what I've seen so far in that space. I won't name any companies because I don't want people to yell at me on Twitter, but I'm not that impressed. I think that like, it's also not something you can really do opportunistically. I think everyone in their head has this idea. You know, I was speaking to Andy Matushak about this, who's perhaps even more cynical than I am he would say he's more realist than I am on sort of this idea of tools for education, tools for thought. And I was speaking to him, and the conversation was essentially like, you know, a lot of people enter this space without being really dedicated to it. They just think of, oh, the Young Ladies Illustrated primer from Diamond Age, and we'll just build that. Which you know, is probably part of the story, but it's not the whole thing. And then once you start running into like the realities of it, it's very easy to sort of be doing the wrong thing because the optics you chose early on are wrong. Anyway, that's a long rambling answer, but
I agree with you, though. I think like the private education sector is definitely somewhat of an opportunity, and especially sort of the B2C personal education, personal productivity space. For example, Replit, which I think you guys partnered with, is like
we love Replit. Amjad is actually an investor in Chroma as well.
Yeah, you might say it doesn't really fall into edtech, or it's sort of on the edge.
Well, edtech, right? I would suggest that Replit is empowering. And I think all of the best education tools are empowering first and foremost. And if you speak to Amjad, or if you sort of, you know, listen to his interviews or read anything he's written on the subject, you know, he built Replit first and foremost for people like himself who didn't have access to these empowering technologies early in their lives. And, you know, he's built a successful company on that premise. And this is the sort of thing that I'm talking about when I say you have to kind of be dedicated to the mission. You can't do it opportunistically.
Yep.
But yeah, Replit is education technology in the sense that it enables you to educate yourself.
Right.
It's and more then, than that, of course.
I'm also curious, how did you get into airships, or what caused that interest?
Oh, so this is actually, you know, so I've been interested in airships for a very long time. Actually, there is a photo floating around, and I might be able to dig it out, which is because it's timestamped, so I can prove this. From 2000, and again, from at least 2012, 2013, where I was sketching out, you know, diagrams for a solar-powered airship with some other crazy features, which I'm actually not convinced they would work in real life, but which might. And I think just airships are kind of a misunderstood technology from a variety of angles. Airships have a lot of interesting economic properties, of course. You know, people who talk about airships love to show the sort of energy mass curve for them as transportation systems. You know, there's that famous curve, the name I forget right now, but it just shows the sort of the energy versus transported mass requirements for different varieties of of transportation. And airships have this very interesting place in the curve, which nothing else satisfies. And the reason that they have that place in the curve is because airships are probably the only aircraft which get more efficient as they get larger. And so you can make them arbitrarily large, and they will just get more efficient the larger that they get. And the reason for that is because in the case of airships, the square cube law actually works in your favor, because you have more volume for volume increases as the cube, and surface area increases only as the square, which means that for each additional cubic meter of volume, you'd get less than a cubic meter of drag, which is less than a square meter of drag.
Especially when you have this very like aerodynamic shape. But then isn't there
the streamlining helps. Yeah, you start to get into structural eventually, right? Like gravity comes for us all. But reaching those structural limits would take a very long time. And then of course, you have other issues like, you know, dealing with how do you actually land something that big? How do you service it? But that's all kind of beside the point. These things are all true. But my interest in airships started with the idea that, well, I would like to have a comfortable place to live, which I can basically situate anywhere in the world that I would want at any time, right? And airships are kind of, when they existed as a commercial entity, and you know, people say, oh, we have airships. We have semi-rigid airships. We don't have rigid airships anymore. There are no rigid airships flying today.
With rigid, you mean like things you can just place somewhere, or?
Rigid means that you have a rigid structure in the aircraft as opposed to just being inflated.
And that difference matters because
the size. In order to build a very large airship, you need to have a rigid airship. In order to build things of the order of, 300 plus feet, 100 plus meters, you need a rigid frame. That's why all the Zeppelins were rigid bodies. You can only build them that big if you build it with a rigid frame. And then I had that idea. I was like, well, these things really, they accommodated, several dozens of people at a time, right, across the Atlantic with 1930s aircraft technology. So if I wanted to live in one of these things with maybe, half a dozen people, my family, plus visitors, that sounds completely feasible. So I started researching this and how it would actually work, and went pretty deep on it in the history, and I found other people interested in this stuff, like Casey Hanmer and Eli Durotter. There are people interested in airships around the world, and there are even companies who started them. But my perspective on it was like, well, wait a minute, we already have this technology from the 1930s. All we really have to do is adapt it with the new technologies we have. We don't have to get fancy here at all. We already know how to do this. And then I started thinking about, well, okay, how do you do this practically? And over the last few years, basically, I've sort of refined my ideas and kind of developed a concept, which I think is the way to do things. And I think that while it's true that airships have these economic benefits, I think the fact that what you actually have here is a floating mega yacht that can go anywhere in the world is, that's an interesting market to go after. And it's a high margin market, unlike cargo. It's a high margin market. It's independent largely of business cycles. It's independent of fuel prices, because the competition for yachts is a purely kind of vanity thing. It's not really a vanity thing, but it is a luxury good, right? So if you sell them as luxury goods, the economics is completely different to if you were trying to build a cargo business around them. And of course, how do you beat Jeff Bezos's yacht? Well, you put a skyscraper in the sky. I feel like that's a pretty bold statement. Yeah. And I think that the other thing about airships important to me is that they're as symbols, they kind of change your perspective of what's possible. If you're an ordinary person, and this is something I think about a lot, I think that societies, and sometimes people call this the Overton window, but the Overton window is like this political idea, it's kind of stupid. I think that as societies and as individuals, people have at any time in history, a limited sense of what's actually possible to do, right? And then there are these events that happen, which changes the society's conception of what it's possible to do. So, regrettably, the most recent example that I can think of is fairly negative, which is either COVID or it's, the September 11th attacks in New York. But there are positive versions of this too, right? There are events that happen in history which change the individual and social conceptions of what's possible. And I think that seeing a skyscraper floating above a capital city in the world is something that will change people's conception of what's possible. And so my perspective on airships, the thing that I get criticized the most for like selling airships as a luxury good to bootstrap this business is like, well, these are toys for rich people. So what? Rich people historically have built public monuments for the public good. And this is a public monument. It is a demonstration of what's actually possible. And it opens up people's eyes and minds. And if the wealthy and the ultra wealthy in particular can subsidize the bootstrapping of a business so that this technology becomes very widely available, and we have this massively efficient form of air transportation, the technology of which is worked out and flight approved in a very high margin business, in this luxury goods business, then that's a benefit to everybody. So that's kind of my thinking. And I can go into the sort of technical details about how I would do it and what I think it would cost. And this is, a very rough sketch for a concept, but I think we could build it today. I really think we can build it today.
We'd love to hear sort of a brief pricing breakdown or like upfront cost versus
liquid time. Absolutely. Absolutely. So look, what we should go is and look at the price that the market will bear for a luxury good of this type. So we're comparing it to mega yachts. We're talking about a three three or four stateroom mega yacht, except it's in the sky. Those things go for 100, 120 million. The first couple you can sell for probably more because they'll be unique in the world, right? Only a few people will have access to them, which means that they're very supply constrained. And so the price will be very high. But I think actually building the company that builds these things is going to cost under $100 million. The reason for that is fairly straightforward. The engineering development that you need to undergo here is actually very simple. One could take the design for the Hindenburg and replace all of the components with modern materials instead. So in other words, matching the tolerances, matching the sort of the stresses and strains, as long as they're modern materials with modern material properties, which are also flight tested, and this is an important fact, you have to use flight tested materials because your aim to build this company is to have as few regulatory objections as possible. That's the thing that you're actually paying money for. It will take 5 to 7 years minimum for the FAA to start flight approving your airship. And that's the thing that you're actually mostly paying $100 million for. It's to keep your engineers paid and on staff and working on things so that as the FAA testing is going through, you stay solvent as a business. That's it. Because the engineering is very simple. Compared to a aerodynamic lift aircraft, an airship is a very simple thing. It costs about, sort of all in cost is under $100 million to manufacture it, like to actually build a business that manufactures these things. And there's efficiencies to be found along the way. It costs about $500,000 to fill one of these things with helium, and you will be flying helium at the start because the FAA will not approve hydrogen for manned flight, and you have to have manned flight at the start. A lot of airship ideas, and this is where I disagree strongly with Eli in particular, is that I think trying to do so many things at once, trying to do cargo, which is a low margin, high volume business, which you need to build new infrastructure for, which you need to convince, customers to like use your service instead of the things that are already heavily baked into their supply chains. It's very hard. So you can't break into cargo. You can't fly on man. You need to train crews. But fortunately, we actually have the ability to train crews. The Zeppelin company has a training center that you can pay them money to train crews for you. You use as many existing certified components as humanly possible. Fortunately, every component that you want to fly is very simple. I mean, it's an extruded aluminium frame with probably Mylar skin. And then you're flying just like kerosene turboprops as propulsion. And then if you really want to get clever, the other system, which might need more regulatory approval than I'm strictly comfortable with for the first version, but it might be necessary to actually make this work, is something like a boundary layer control set of electric fans positioned around the skin so that you can basically maneuver in the wind more easily. And that's how you do it. And you just build these things and you fit them out for luxury cruises and you sell them. You sell them to the companies that either sell or lease mega yachts. And that's where you start. And you pay back your R&D in a couple of years after you've gone through that 5 or 7 year period. You land a bunch of LOIs, auction these things off, whatever it is you have to do. And then they start appearing in cities or over cities around the world. And then just basically everything changes and suddenly everybody wants one. And so you have a beer in business, basically. It's just expensive and slow. It's not a software company. You can't flip it in a couple of years. You're not going to have giant revenues early on. And you are building a luxury good, which in many ways is something that's difficult to estimate the economic utility of. So, as investors, it's kind of hard to figure out what the returns are going to be. But technically speaking, it's just not a difficult problem.
Mm.
It's simpler than any other kind of aircraft. Almost any other. It's right. Definitely simpler than any aircraft requiring aerodynamic lift.
Interesting. I'm curious on this like broader theme of techno-optimism, do you remember sort of your early influences or why you have this strong optimism towards technology? Is it just something you learn on the way by building stuff, by studying AI, mechanical engineering, or is there like a book or person that influenced you?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think as long as I can remember, I've wanted to make things. Literally as long as I can remember. When I was I have memories from being a very young child and just always playing with toys that allowed me to make something. So I think for me, it's some sort of intrinsic drive, but I think the reason that, for a long period of time, I was actually very cynical, especially around like venture capital backed technological progress. After my first startup sort of didn't succeed and I sort of looked around at what was getting funded in that era, none of it seemed like very taking a step back. I think of technology as currently divided into basically two things. We have convenience technologies, which are things that provide something we could already do, but just more conveniently, right? More easily. So Uber is an example for me of a convenience technology. I have a bunch of ways of getting from point A to point B, right? And before I could even call a taxi, even though it wasn't very good, Uber made it much easier to do that. Amazon is similar. It's a convenience technology because I could buy stuff certainly before Amazon, but Amazon has made it much, much easier and obviously cheaper and put more goods into reach of more people, but it's a convenience technology. And so for a long time, I was very cynical about the venture funded technology because it seemed like the only things that could get funded were these convenience technologies. So we weren't actually moving forward in terms of capabilities. And that's kind of where what I think is important in the long run. It is important in the long run. We need capabilities. But I think, you know, what caused a new snap out of that over a period of time was sort of the feeling that, well, you kind of need one to have the other. You need these massive returns from these other kinds of technologies to have the economic surplus to develop other things. And yeah, but where does the optimism come from? I think it comes out of necessity more than anything else. If you look at and I think it comes from just like understanding history or reading enough about history and kind of thinking about where things came from and how we got to be where we are. If you look at history, most of human history, especially prior to the Industrial Revolution, was awful in ways that we in our time cannot even really imagine. I mean the sorts of things that were ordinary in an ordinary person's life anywhere in the world would be horrific to us today. Horrific in literally unimaginable ways. I mean that very, very literally. We are unable to imagine how bad the past was. We're simply unable to imagine it. Humans are very adaptable. And so we were able to, you know, even do quite amazing things in those times. But the average person's life was just truly, truly horrific. Truly horrific. We talk about, for example, like how parts of San Francisco right now are, you know, quite dirty or have pretty significant social problems. But if you look at like 16th century London, first of all, no sanitation. So there was no understanding of no disease theory, like no biological theories of disease. So people were just sick and dying literally all the time. But also at that time, and this is like a forgotten episode in history, but for a period of time, literally the entire city of London was drunk all the time. I mean that very literally. And the reason that happened is because the British government subsidized the production of gin because it was great for tax revenue. And then what happened was the entire country got so drunk that it started to really drag on just the overall economic progress and became like a matter of national urgency. So they had to go away from subsidizing the gin to trying to eradicate it. Like that's a real thing that happened. It's not even close to the worst thing that happened in history. It's just one tiny event. And the only things that have really changed between now and then is our ability to deal with the problems created by the material world. And the only way that humans have to deal with the problems created by the material world are through the technologies that we create. Because what technology is for humanity is leverage over our material circumstances, leverage over the material world. That's what we're able to do. And yes, of course, a large fraction of technology are actually coordinating technologies or things that allow humans to cooperate better with other humans or achieve a given task better or, you know, find the acceptable level for a variety of things in our society. But ultimately, all of these things are to influence the material world. Technology is humans' ability to influence the material world. It is the thing that stops us being at the mercy of a universe which simply does not care about our existence and will impose itself on us if we allow it to. Technology is humans' way of imposing our values on the universe. Because without it, we're completely helpless, right? Technology has taken us so far that we have exceeded the physical capabilities of every other species on the planet, collectively, right? There is no species on the planet that could possibly, even collectively, even if every single member of that species got together, with the possible exception of mosquitoes, if they understood, you know, germ theory of disease, which if they banded together could really hope to inflict anything on us anymore, right? And we're still very much at the mercy of material circumstances in the world. And, you know, you think about things like climate, and then you think about things even more kind of scary than that, space, weather, and things of that nature, which we don't control and we don't really have good answers for yet. We've come a long way, and technology is the only thing that's allowed us to do that.
Even climate, I think you might say that with the technological progress, we have way more protection against climate catastrophes than
we have the means to reverse it. We have the means to reverse it. We have enough technological shots on goal here that we can figure this out. It's just a question of will, right? Any of possible approaches. I mean, my personal favorite is sort of this basalt rock weathering thing, because all you do is crush up a bunch of rocks and then you bury them. Super, like, it just seems pretty easy to me. And, you know, we even know where all the basalt deposits are, so it's fairly straightforward. They happen to be in the United States as well, which is great, because it means the United States can just solve this problem unilaterally if they ever choose to do so. And that gives us enough breathing room to sort of catch up with lower emission technologies. It's fairly straightforward.
With Chroma, sort of your journey starting that, I'm curious, how does that fit into this, like, convenience versus capabilities technologies framework, or any other sort of framework? Where did you guys had like a list of ideas that or avenues to go into and then analyze sort of all the options?
So Jeff and I have known each other since 2018, and we've always known each other in the context of startups and being founders. I actually did some contract work for Jeff's previous company as well, doing some 3D tracking stuff for Standard Cyborg, which is his previous company. And I think what we talked about the most was, what sort of company did we want to build next? Like, even before we decided that we would be co-founders, it's like, well, what do we care about in startups? Why do we want to do these things? What's important, right? So we didn't, it's not like we sat down and went through like a list of ideas wanting to found a startup. I think that's actually one of the worst possible ways to do a startup, is like deciding that you want to do a startup first and then going down a list of ideas, deciding which idea you're going to do. You should have an idea already that you can't help but work on, and you have to be making the choice, like, am I going to do this full time or not? And also, again, like, you need to have already worked on the idea. You can't sort of decide, well, I'm going to do a startup and then start working on the idea. It's like, no, listen, I've been doing this nights and weekends for so long now, and I have to make a decision between letting this go and making it my life. So that's kind of the story here as well. We got to a point where Jeff and I had been discussing different things so long, and using our experiences in 3D computer vision and a lot of other things to get at the first idea we had for Chroma, which was this open source active learning set of tools. And we decided that this is a strong enough idea. It's worth pursuing. We've built the prototype. It seems to work. We can commit to this full time. And of course, timing is a big part of it. It was good timing for me, pretty good timing for Jeff. So it's kind of how we came to be where we are. That's sort of the founding. That's part of your question. It's like the founding story. The other part of your question is like, where do I see Chroma fitting into this landscape of like technological progress, right? So AI is a very broad, very general purpose technology. The core bet that Chroma is making as a company is this technology is going to be extremely important, right? We're basically betting against AI winter. That's the big bet of the company. And the lower bound that we've set is like, okay, this technology is just going to be as at least as important as the web. And so Chroma is in the fortunate position of being a enabling technology for that general purpose technology. We are infrastructure and enabling for that general purpose technology. We are the memory layer for AI. That's what we're actually building. We are programmable memory for AI, which is important and valuable. And we're so early into this AI story, even though it feels like, you know, it feels like we've already been doing this for a decade, but it hasn't. It's just things have been moving so rapidly, especially in the last 2 years, that we want to build something that enables that. We're so early, and that means that there's a great deal of exploration that needs to be done in this space. The analogy that I always use here is, it's like the web in 1994, people have realized that this is, some people in some places in the world have realized that this is going to be somehow a big deal. They're not sure exactly how. And that's the same, that's true of AI today. We have existing very powerful use cases, don't get me wrong. But the future isn't like, it's clear that this is a generally purpose, a generally useful technology, but exactly what the most powerful things are going to be haven't emerged yet. And it feels like 1993. And so because of that, the best thing that we could be doing as a company is enabling that exploration, making it as easy as possible. And that's how we've built Chroma. It's how we think about it. We are 100% focused on these AI use cases. And that's kind of our place in this curve, is to enable as many different ideas to be tried as quickly as possible with the technologies emerging today. And something very gratifying about it is that sort of direction that we've picked seems to be paying off. Very recently, the Voyager paper, which is this Minecraft playing bot that uses LLMs as the backend. I don't know if you saw this paper.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Yeah. So basically it like learns skills in Minecraft and then remembers them when it comes across a similar context. That uses Chroma as its memory, which I was very surprised by. I actually saw the paper and retweeted it. And then later on, I looked in the repo and it was us. And that was kind of incredible because we didn't cooperate with that research team directly at all. They just picked up Chroma because it was the right thing to use. And that's very gratifying because it means that our idea around how to do this is at least a little bit, has some, a little bit validation.
I haven't read the paper. Sorry. How does the Minecraft bot decide what to put in the sort of knowledge base of new, is it like when there's a word signal, it like writes some notes on like how it
So it reads the state. It reads the state of the world. It parses the state of the world. And then it finds relevant things in its memory to the current state of the world. And then it unrolls, basically it unrolls the stored instructions. So what it does is it has a textual description of a skill or a situation, which it then embeds and stores in Chroma. That embedding is associated with a associated program, which is also generated by the model. And so when it recalls the appropriate textual description, it pulls in the program and executes it. That's how it works.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
On the retrieval architecture, I haven't fully understood this one step where, so I know like you retrieve a bunch of relevant text from your embeddings or images or whatever, and then you put this together with the Q&A prompt, and I assume an additional prompt that says like, based on this question and these embeddings, answer the question, right? Is it just like a normal sort of internally, it uses a normal like prompt interface, or is there something else going on?
So, I mean, Chroma itself retrieves the relevant documents for you. You don't need to see embeddings as a user at all. And again, that's by design. Because the capability we're giving you has nothing to do with embeddings. It's about retrieving the appropriate information. Remember, programmable memory. That's the metaphor. And so, yeah, you as a developer will have some prompt that says, using the following context, right? You'll say, answer the following query using the following context, or perform the following task using the following context. Now, you've hit on something interesting here, a little bit obliquely, which is, you phrase this as question answering or like query answering, right?
Right.
But that's a very narrow conception of what's actually going on here. You have to think of it more like, I am giving the model the information it needs to perform a task. So that task may be query answering, but it may also be like, what do I do in this Minecraft situation, right? So it's very general.
Hmm.
And part of what's interesting right now is showing people what's possible for the first time. People figure out, like, most people have a really hard time coming up with something from a blank page, right? They would love to like, oh, I want to play with AI, but they don't really know what to do. So if you create references for them, if you create little recipes that they can toy with and be like, oh, I saw this thing, I'm going to try it for my use case. Like, I'm going to try it for this other domain. That's a very valuable and powerful thing to be doing. And that's part of why we're doing the Hacker in Residence program, is so that those guys can generate some cool new recipes for the community. But yeah, like it's very early.
And the recipes, is that like a specific format or is it like, or is it just a GitHub repo?
It's just a GitHub repo with a write-up, realistically. That's mostly what it is. Like, if you see something like AutoGPT or maybe AGI, it's just a GitHub repo that people can run for themselves. It needs to be easy to install and run. If it has like tons of configuration, then people won't use it. So that's the other important thing to remember. That's one of the reasons that Chroma is so popular, is that you need zero configuration to turn us on. You don't even need to get an API key. You just literally pip install Chroma and you're good.
Makes sense. I'm also curious, since you're like really on the edge of this stuff, what are sort of the latest innovations besides Chroma, off retrieval and like knowledge retrieval, or the different algorithms and techniques?
Yeah, I'm really bullish on direct retrieval augmentation of transformers. I think that that's very interesting. And we see, you know, there's about a paper every couple of weeks in this direction. There was one I was reading just now, actually, before we jumped on this podcast. Because when you think about it, inside a transformer, the main thing that makes it work is these, you know, self-attention mechanisms. And attention is basically, you know, a dot product. It's a programmable dot product. It's a reweighting of the encoded vector according to the self-attention. But a dot product is also directly, like it maps directly to the nearest neighbor problem, right? Like the things with the highest dot product are the nearest neighbors under the dot product. So what that means is you can turn the attention mechanism into a key value lookup. And of course, you know, it's called QKV. And anyway, it is already a key value lookup thing. It comes from information retrieval, that metaphor for it. So if you can literally put a key value store underneath the attention mechanism, you give this explicit memory to the transformer architecture. And I'm very bullish on that. I think that that's very interesting and very exciting. There's other pieces to this, which we're also exploring. Recently, I put out like the topics, the research topics that Chrome is interested in. We're hiring for applied research as well as a number of roles across software engineering and other pieces. But tightly coupled retrieval, thinking about how we can do conditional retrieval based on the query, because it, like the example that I always have is, it may be the same knowledge base, but one query might be like, find me all the angry tweets. And another query might be, find me all the tweets about ducks, right? And if you think about tweets, you know, embedded, once they're embedded, they're represented by this high dimensional vector. For each of those queries, different pieces of that dimensionality are going to have more salience than others. But which ones have more salience is conditional on the query itself. So it's like, how do we do query conditioned retrieval? And then, you know, again, that makes me think of, well, what we're asking for is a reweighting of the vectors, which is the same as applying a transform over the vector space. So we need a conditional transform over the vector space, which starts looking a lot like the attention mechanism again. There's a lot of interesting things to explore here. And then adding human feedback to relevancy, that's something that we're looking into. It's like, how do you determine whether the results you're getting are actually good, right? How do you incorporate human feedback for relevancy? And then how do you incorporate that at scale? These are important questions. So there's a lot to do here, but I think the other important thing is to not over-index too much on any of the use cases that exist today. We want to support them effectively. We want to be the easiest and best thing for the things that people are actually building today. And fortunately, we have a clear path to doing that. But I think it's also very important that we remain easy to use and flexible enough that new use cases can easily emerge. And then we'll build for them as well. Because again, like I said, the real power of this stuff is in the future. We have not had any native applications built yet in AI, because everything that we built so far, they just look like stuff we were already doing with AI, which is a lot like the early web, which is like, okay, well, people thought of the early web as just another publishing medium. So what did they do? They took magazines and put them online. They took the yellow pages and they put them online, right? The great, valuable, powerful things to be doing, important things to be doing even, but you know, it's not the most powerful things that we got out of the web. The most powerful things that we got out of the web were these web native ideas. And think of Yahoo, which there would be no reason to build Yahoo if there wasn't already millions and millions of websites, right? And the other one that I always think about is Amazon. Amazon realized that besides zero marginal cost of distribution of your catalog, you could also have infinite shelf space, which means that you could finally capture the long tail of requests, right? And that's why Jeff Bezos was deciding between CDs and books for the first things that Amazon would sell. And they landed on books, I think, because the long tail was better, if I remember correctly. I've read the Everything Store, but it was a while ago. And so that's something you can only do with the web. It's something you can only do with the web. You can't do it without the web.
And sort of these like Jarvis-like chatbots or even OpenAI.
It's early. It's early.
Chat is not a native application because it's like sort of the existing chat interface, or?
It's not a native application because of the chat interface. It's just doing something we already do. And I think the really powerful things are going to be things we cannot yet do. The one that I really want, like the first one of these that I can clearly picture in my head is I want, okay, back in the 80s, back when expert systems were the AI, people started talking about software agents. which were these little autonomous things that would live in your computer and they would handle tasks for you, basically, completely autonomously. Couldn't be done then, but I think they could be done now. And I would love a little autonomous email agent that like basically asked me a bunch of questions about how I wanted most of my email handled. And then when it didn't know what to do with my email, it would ask me what I wanted. And then it would learn from me and then just handle it, right? And then you can imagine a world where everyone has one of these assistants, and then the assistants are mostly talking to each other. So you can actually eliminate a lot of the back and forth as well. You can just make it more efficient because they're assistants talking to each other. So they already like fully understand each other.
They would have to find some code words to communicate or expertly say like, hey, I'm an assistant, right?
Not necessarily. Yeah, I mean, look, they would identify each other as assistants, but it's more like they would develop, you would develop protocols that are not for humans and humans to talk to each other. They would be for these things to talk over a network. That's what they're really doing. So that's like a more native application. But again,
right,
my imagination is limited. Everyone's imagination is limited.
Right.
Until you start exploring more of this capability, you just don't know. The other thing that I really want, which I've been experimenting with myself, and I'll probably do a little bit more of experimentation tonight about this, is when AlphaGo came out, you know, and then the famous games against Lee Sedol, and then the famous Move 37, right? Are you familiar with the Move 37?
That was one where everyone was like surprised and by the creativity
yes.
and so on.
Mm-hmm. They were surprised. It was so counterintuitive. That move was so counterintuitive. And it was so counterintuitive. It's like, one perspective on it was like, oh, well, that's it. There's now superhuman performance of computers on Go. You know, Go is like a pointless game. Except what really happened afterwards was the Go community were like, shit, there's so much we don't even know yet about this ancient game, right?
Yeah.
We thought we knew everything, but we don't. And they looked at how this thing played and they started using its intuitions to find new and more creative moves for themselves as humans. I want that for other fields. So the thing that I really want, I want a Move 37 for mathematics. That's what I'm looking for. That's kind of the dream with the little theorem prover bot that I made, which I'm going to retrofit with Lean and try again probably later tonight. Because Coq is like fine, but I think my implementation struggles a little bit, and there's a lot more Lean information out there than there is Coq information. So I'm going to try Lean as the proof assistant. But yeah, ultimately that's what I want. I want a Move 37 for mathematics.
Did you see this? Oh, go ahead.
No, it's fine. Go ahead.
Did you see the DeepMind stuff from 2021? I think it's called
yes.
Exploring the Beauty of Pure Mathematics in Novel Ways.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this is
that
all
similar. Or?
I mean, in 2021, we didn't have GPT-4.
True.
I mean, there's a 2020 paper from OpenAI, right? Which was also about theorem proving. I've been talking to Stanislas Polu about it.
So not that you have like specific models trained on this mathematical sort of models you're trying to explore, but you use GPT-4 to like.
Let's take a step back. We have automatic theorem provers. Automatic theorem provers basically use substitution rules in a formal grammar to arrive at theorems, right? You start with axioms, you arrive at theorems. That's what an automatic theorem prover is. This is something that's existed for a very long time. It's a fairly straightforward concept, even though it's difficult to implement in practice. The thing is that purely automatically generated proofs are unsatisfying to us as human mathematicians. The reason that they're unsatisfying is because part of the point of doing mathematics is that you can construct a human understandable chain of reasoning. For some definition of human understandable, of course, you know, if you look at the Mochizuki and the ABC conjecture, that's, you know, debatable whether it's human understandable. The man is possibly an alien. But the reason we do math is to create a human understandable chain of reasoning from here to there. We want to understand something. We want to have a reason for the steps that we're taking. Even if the steps that we're taking at the time seem like this enormous leap, right? The insight that they give us is what's important. We don't really care. We don't always care about the proof. The proof is nice. Don't get me wrong. It's like great to have a result to like decide a conjecture or you know, test a hypothesis, show a very interesting counterexample. All these things have historically created really huge opportunities in mathematics. But the thing that we really want is interpretability, understandability. Right. Just having an exhaustive table of like worked examples and showing this one works, this one doesn't, gives us no insight. It's the insight that's important. So historically, automatic theorem provers produce proofs, and the proofs are correct, guaranteed, but they don't really give us insight. They just produce the proof. And so what I'm hoping by using language backbone, which in principle encodes some amount of human reasoning, I'm actually not as bullish as like Ilya Sutskever is about this. I don't think that the language models are there yet. I don't think they reason yet. I have good concrete reasons for thinking that. People will yell at me about them. I don't care. They're wrong. But we encode some amount of human reasoning, right? By doing this predictive token thing, right? And the reason that we get that is not because the models have learned to reason. It's not because the models have what Ilya calls this like process prediction going on inside them, right? They're not actually modeling the processes that created the language. They're still modeling the language itself. But fortunately, the main thing that humans use language for is to convey some sort of reasoning. So even having just a model that predicts language is enough to partially get you a reasoning system. And then you strap that onto a formal system to like check whether the reasoning is correct or not. It gets rid of this, you know, grammatically correct but not a theorem set of statements. And so what I'm hoping to do is, again, find some explainable but novel step. That would be very exciting. It has to be explainable and like some fundamentally new way of thinking about things. That would be exciting.
And to recap, the reason you think it's not doing reasoning is more so that you think they're imitating our reasoning.
It's not that they're imitating our reasoning. They are imitating language, but language encodes reason. So what Ilya says is a language model is reasoning because the best way to predict language is to actually model the process that would generate the language, right? And that's true. I don't disagree with him. Of course that's true. I just don't think models are doing that yet. Unless there's something about GPT-4 that I don't know. But to me, like, the thing that would prove that that's the case, to me, hasn't happened yet. I would need to see a model with a lower parameter count and more efficient inference performing better than a larger model. And I would say, okay, yeah, that one is encoding something more about the world than the previous one did. For now, we haven't seen that. We just made them bigger, and being bigger provides us with more parameters to have the correlates. Not the same thing. Modeling a process requires you to have like lower complexity because you have the process. You no longer have all the statistical correlates of the process.
Right.
This is like how people the other day were yelling at me about how I supposedly don't understand Kolmogorov complexity while entirely misunderstanding Kolmogorov complexity. But that's okay. People get things wrong on the internet a lot.
Especially unless wrong.
I mean, look, this is the thing. Because I'm such an optimist about these technologies, people think that I'm often like positioned against Eliezer, right? And the less wrong memeplex. And I often characterize myself as probably among the people in the world who have read the most less wrong and alignment literature and still fundamentally disagree with most of the premises. I think that's a very small fraternity, and I'm certainly a member of it. I actually think there's a lot of good that's come out of those communities and the rationality community in general. And as much as I make fun of them, oftentimes I do respect them, at least for their intellectual honesty, except they sometimes don't notice when they fall off their intellectual honesty. It's hard to convince them because they think, because most of the criticism that they get is of the form of your aesthetics are bad, which to be fair, they're bad. They would do a lot better if their aesthetics were better, but they're used to that form of criticism. And so they start mistaking every criticism to be of that form when in fact I'm actually saying something else. I wouldn't say that like people unless wrong are especially stupid or wrong. I just think that they have ultimately fallen into a local minima for their own principles, and it's not always the best, but they are wrong about a lot of what they've said about my recent post about recursive self-improvement and Kolmogorov complexity. I still need to address that, but of course I'm busy, so it's hard.
I'll put this in the show notes. I'm curious, on one thing, on your career page you quoted you and your research and against method. Did you put these in there, or
actually Jeff put those in there, right? But we agree on those.
Okay, I haven't read both of them, I think. Would you mind sort of describing like your main takeaways from those, or why you find these important reads?
So I have Against Method on my bookshelf. I haven't read it yet. But if I remember, the main contention is that hewing too close to a particular way of doing things forces you to make the tasks that you're performing or make the ideas that you're having legible to that particular framework, which causes you to miss out on just how broad the world actually is, right? The world is much broader than any single framework we can put it under. And the only way to learn that, I feel, is life experience. I don't think you can be taught it any other way. And then in terms of Hamming's point is more or less, you actually can be excellent if you dedicate yourself to excellence. You just have to decide that that's what you're going to do. You have to take yourself seriously enough, right? You have to basically take, if you're going to do something great, you have to take yourself seriously enough to want to pursue something great instead of just having the effect, which, you know, I agree with strongly. And that's, again, a mentality that I had to adopt over time, because coming from a fairly cynical culture on a number of dimensions, it's hard to sometimes imagine that it's possible to really do anything important, which I think is something that many people either explicitly or intrinsically believe about themselves. It's like, oh, it's impossible to actually do anything, so let's not try. Let's be like these irony poisoned whatevers, which I don't agree with. And that's basically what Hamming is saying. Hamming is like, be serious about your work. Like, be serious about it. Choose ambitious things and like pursue them as if they are real, more or less.
And then going back to the previous point, I'd love to hear your take on sort of, so we talked pretty optimistically about AI, and is there some steelman regarding the job displacement, or how do you think about job displacement and the role of agents in like the software engineering job profession?
It's a really good question. I think that ultimately every new technology can have significant effects on jobs, on people's work. In fact, in order for a technology to be economically successful, it must necessarily have a large impact on the work that people do, necessarily, right? So in terms of like economic disruption, I think that, and the other thing is people only ever think about the supply side of this. They're like, oh, job automation is going to take away people's jobs and, you know, people will be poor, but it kind of forgets the demand creation part of this. Like, if you can produce goods and services more efficiently, and you can serve more demand. And so what ends up happening is like, actually everything gets cheaper and better over time. The main thing that I think about is like the Model T Ford and the assembly line process, like considerably cheaper and faster to build a Model T Ford because of the large degree of, you know, what was automation at that time. But it also meant that literally a worker on the Model T Ford assembly line could buy a Model T Ford. It's kind of a big deal, right? It went from cars being the province exclusively of wealthy people and then being toys to being something practical that could actually drive, the economy on its own. Actually, people should read Henry Ford's book. People should read My Life and Work. You don't have to agree with all of it, and I certainly don't recommend that you agree with the last chapter, but it's very interesting to see how Ford thought about the Model T Ford, not just as a car, but as part of a complete economic system, right? He basically says, yeah, if you can make this thing affordable such that millions of people can have one, suddenly you create opportunities that didn't exist before. And I think about automation and I think about AI in the same way.
You cannot
just have a supply side improvement of the economy, right? Because the additional wealth created has to go somewhere. It necessarily must create additional demand. Otherwise, nobody's paying for that extra efficiency. It doesn't make sense. Of course, it's more complicated than that, and of course, it's going to create disruption. I'm less worried about the economic disruption than I am about the social disruption, because historically, the social disruption has been much, much worse than the economic.
What are some worse social disruption or bad social disruption examples?
Yeah, I mean, look, the rise of the printing press caused the 30 Years' War, the single most deadly per capita conflict in European history to this day. Much
Could
worse
you
than World War One.
Elaborate.
Sure. Yeah. So the printing press allowed the ideas of the Protestants, Martin Luther, to spread throughout Europe, whereas before they would have been a local Christian schism. And that basically broke the power of the papacy and changed, you know, the legitimacy of the European princes and where they drew their legitimacy from, and caused the 30 Years' War. Where basically, because there was no longer a central unifying authority and no longer a central unifying source of legitimacy to the European monarchies, just massive, massive social upheaval, war. Parts of Germany were depopulated by 50%. It's insane. 50% of people in certain German provinces died It's crazy. It's crazy social conflict. And that was just the printing press. It was the first media technology.
Seems quite strong of an argument to attribute that to the printing press, right? Wasn't it more so the bad ideas that sort of were embedded in these societies and all the kings that were sort of constraining the output?
No, of course, nothing is monocausal. Nothing is ever monocausal. Of course, the other social tensions needed already to be in place, right? Like there needed to already be Northern German princes who were unhappy with being ruled by the Holy Roman Empire and the Pope, right? This needed to already, like the central authority of the Holy Roman Empire needs to already have been weakened. You know, you needed to have this like Habsburg thing and then, you know, William of Orange and all the rest of it. So it all had to be set up for sure. But the existence of the printing press turned this from a slow to a fast moving conflict. You turned it from a hypothetical to a realized. And the same thing with totalitarianism. Right, the rise of totalitarianism is in part due to newspapers and the radio. Both communism and fascism are directly attributable to the rise of newspapers and the radio in Europe, because I think there is this effect which you kind of see over and over again. You know, you have the printing press and you have the newspaper and the radio and then television and then the movies and then television and then the internet and social media. Every time there is a novel, fast-growing media technology, and one way to look at AI is a novel, fast-growing media technology. In fact, a lot of it is explicitly developed as a media technology. Collectively, human society doesn't have an immune system to messages delivered over that new technology. We're susceptible to them because we haven't seen them before. There's something about the human psychology that causes us to believe things like that, right? Like, I remember, again, showing my age, I remember in the early web, you were very explicitly told, don't use your real name, don't use any personal details, don't believe anything you read because anyone at all could put anything on the web. It's true, there was no publishing standard. I think you just put stuff on there. And now we're in this situation where like people uncritically believe all kinds of shit. People uncritically believe things I tweet all the time, even though half of them are shitposts. Like, there's something in our psychology that prevents us from critically examining messages delivered over a new kind of media. And AI it can be looked at as a new kind of media. And because one of the things that AI does better than other technologies is adapt to human preferences, it means that you have a form of media that adapts to you. So you now have like the possibility of like individually targeted adaptable propaganda down to the individual level, right? Which we're unprepared for psychologically because it seems that we don't have these barriers in our minds. So that worries me. That kind of social disruption worries me. And it also worries me because of just the current state of the world seems to be in flux, in a great deal of flux. And those are dangerous times. So that worries me much more than the economic shift caused by automation. Automation will create opportunities that we can't, like economic opportunities that we can't even imagine, just as we couldn't imagine economic opportunities in 1993 that the web would create.
For sure. Yeah, I think we're quite a bit over time, and this was very fascinating.
No worries.
Definitely want to thank you for this and some very interesting points. Thanks for coming on, and have a nice one.
You too, Maritz. Great chat.
Ciao.